Left-wingers don't know what to do with him. Anti-Semites hate his guts. They would give anything to get him off the radio. Tovia Singer. Coming up next on Israel National Radio.
Holy Jews and Gentiles, lovers of Zion around the world, you're listening to the Tovia Singer Show, Israel National Radio. Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief, worldnetdaily.com. He'll be joining us. You wouldn't believe this. The lost tribes of Israel, at least those, the descendants of Menashe, are coming home. They were traveling thousands of miles west to the Holy Land. Much more what's going on in Syria. There's been an assassination, and it's brought enormous turmoil to a country already in enormous trouble. And, of course, the French are threatening to shoot down Israeli Air Force jets right over Lebanon. That and much more right here on air. Don't touch the dial. All right, Singer here, Israel National Radio. Joining me right now, Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief, worldnetdaily.com. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tovia.
Hey, great having you on. Let's begin. Let's talk about what's going on in Lebanon. A leading opponent of Syria was assassinated, ostensibly by Syria. What's the deal there?
Indeed. For about a year and a half, the leaders of Lebanon, those on the anti-Syrian camp, have been trying to build a country of freedom, democracy, and essentially away from the presence of Syrian occupation. It's been a year and a half since the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, former Prime Minister of Lebanon, for which Syria was widely blamed. The assassination prompted street protests with millions of Lebanese calling for Syria to remove its army that had occupied the country for 30 years. Syria finally acquiesced, removed its army, but since then they've been carrying out, or they're accused of carrying out a campaign of terror against anti-Syrian politicians and media personalities in Lebanon. They've killed six so far, or they've been accused of killing six, and the latest was this week, Pierre Gamaliel, who's a leader of the parliament, of the anti-Syrian majority in the parliament. He's the son of Lebanon's former president, very prominent politician, assassinated. Syria is being very widely blamed. I had the opportunity to talk with Walid Jumblatt, who's the most prominent anti-Syrian politician in Lebanon, a leader of the parliament there, and he personally blames Syria outright for the assassination, but he said something very interesting. He said that the change in attitude from America, the election earlier this month of the Democrats in the midterm elections, which seems to be calling for the removal of U.S. troops in Iraq, seems to be calling for a change in U.S. policy in the Middle East. He believes that this new American attitude toward the region here has emboldened Syria to create what he says is chaos in the region, and he says that one of the latest casualties of this new Syrian emboldenment is the assassination this week of Pierre Gamaliel. I actually just hours ago talked to Sammy Gamaliel, the brother of Pierre who was assassinated. He says he's going to be taking over and that he hopes to use the assassination and use this clear flagrant violation of Lebanese sovereignty to call for the dismantlement of a lot of the Hezbollah government that still is trying to occupy, as he says, the Lebanese establishment.
Just to be sure, the industry minister Pierre Gemayel, who was just murdered, this is the son of Bashir Gemayel, who was assassinated.
He's the son of Amin Gemayel.
Amin Gemayel,
who was the president of Lebanon. He's still alive. He's the nephew of Bashir, who was assassinated, actually in part because he wanted to He agreed to some sort of peace deal with Israel. And I can tell you, because I talk regularly with the opposition in Lebanon, and they're not the opposition, actually they're the majority in Lebanon, the anti-Syrian establishment, that these are people who in the near future, if they aren't afraid, if they no longer fear for their lives and fear for the continued occupation of their government and of their country by Syria, they would be willing to make peace with Israel. They speak privately passionately about the Jewish state, and even Sami Gamayel, who is now going to take over for his assassinated brother, he's going to try to run as industry minister, says he'd like to come and visit Israel one day, and he hopes that Israel and Lebanon, they are neighbors, will one day be at full peace, but not when Syria continues to plague Lebanon with these campaigns of terrorism and of assassination of their top officials.
Do you think that this assassination is going to nourish anti-Hezbollah sentiment in Lebanon that may bode poorly for the terrorist organization?
I think that for a very short period of time, the anti-Syrian, pro-Lebanese, pro-freedom, pro-democratic government in Lebanon has this window of opportunity to perhaps march through the streets, to perhaps call for the resignation of Amir Lahoud, who is the pro-Syrian president, who incredibly wasn't elected. He was literally established there and put into office by Syria. But if you look at what's going on in Lebanon and what's been going on the past few weeks, Hezbollah has some seats in the parliament, but they don't at all have a majority. The pro-Syrian camp is in the minority. Hezbollah left the government last week. They've been threatening street protests and threatening that unless they're given more power, unless they're actually given veto power over the Lebanese government, that they're going to create instability. The problem is that the Shiite population, those who support Hezbollah in Lebanon, are a good percentage. We're talking about nearly 40% of Lebanon. Then you have the majority, about nearly 60%, that supports the anti-Syrian establishment that is against Hezbollah. And so it's a very unstable situation. It's a powder keg, and it could be that this latest incident, if it's not played out correctly on both sides, don't really massage their new direction and coordinate on some level. There could be a civil war in Lebanon sparked in part because of this assassination.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The Socialist Party's leader, Walid Jumblatt, the Druze leader who you were in contact with regularly, he has no interest in making peace with Israel. Is that right?
Well, publicly he says that he doesn't. Privately, we do talk about different things. I don't have his permission to put it on the record. But I can tell you that he knows that I'm here in Israel. He knows that that when he talks to me, it's going to get out to the Israeli media. He has no problem with that. He calls me in Israel. And I think that in general, his establishment, those of the anti-Syrian majority, that there is a feeling that if they're not afraid, if they don't have to worry about Syrian dominance and Syrian terrorism, that in the future they would be willing to make peace with Israel. But yet Jumblatt has made some statements that are pro-Palestinian, not really anti-Israel, but in general, actually, his enemies are the same as the Jewish state, the same as America. It's the Palestinian camps in Lebanon that have been helping Hezbollah, that have been helping with the infiltration, continued infiltration of weapons from Syria to Lebanon. Reports actually that Hezbollah has been storing weapons in Palestinian camps. So he talks the talk, because if he comes out if he comes out pro-Israel, it could really hurt his standing. But in the future, I do believe that people in his camp may be willing to make peace with Israel.
All right. If you're just tuning in, my guest, Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief, WorldNetDaily.com. WorldNetDaily.com, one of the largest news websites in the world. And you can subscribe to the G2 report on WorldNetDaily.com. That's a special report. It's a premium intelligence report. My guest contributes regularly to that report, where you can get the news and the intelligence behind what is readily available in the news. Aaron, let's stay in Lebanon for another moment, then we're going to move all the way south to Sderot. It's hard to get this out of my mouth. I'm going to say this. The UNIFIL troops, the international troops under the supervision of the United Nations as part of, I was going to call surrender. as part of Security Council 1701, UN ceasefire accord. The job of the French soldiers are, I guess, as I understood it, was to shoot at Hezbollah in order to protect the Jewish state from, you know, to prevent Hezbollah from rearming and using those arms to attack the Jewish state. As it turns out, the French have got orders to shoot, but not to shoot at Hezbollah. The reports are coming in, and I can feel my spleen spinning. The French just received permission to be shooting at Israeli Air Force jets with anti-aircraft missiles. What the hell are the French doing with anti-aircraft missiles to begin with? Hezbollah doesn't have any aircraft. I mean, help me out over here.
It's incredible, and it's only a matter of time. Only a matter of time before there's a confrontation between Israel and the international troops there in Lebanon. If in the future Israel needs to carry out any action against Hezbollah, they're going to be hampered by the French and the German and other European troops in Lebanon. It's a disaster. And you have now this situation where Hezbollah is openly reestablishing its bases, is openly smuggling weapons, and I wouldn't even use the word smuggling any at this point. They're openly bringing weapons from Syria into Lebanon in full view of the international forces there. And yet, the United Nations forces have now been charged not to disarm Hezbollah, not to stop the infiltration of these militants and weapons from Syria into Lebanon, but actually to fire at the Israeli Air Force that has been conducting surveillance along the Syrian-Lebanese border to try to find out and get more intelligence information on where the weapons are coming from. Israel has repeatedly taken these reconnaissance pictures of the weapons being brought in from Syria, of Hezbollah reestablishing its bases. They're passing the information on to the United Nations troops, and the UN troops are doing nothing. It's going to happen. Israel and the international forces are going to get into a confrontation. There's going to be a disaster.
What happens?
Not on the international force, because they're just being Europe. Of course, this is what Europe is going to do if they're charged with protecting the Israeli border. Blame is on Omar. And the so-called ceasefire that, as you very accurately stated, was a surrender to Hezbollah, and now to the international forces. And incredibly, with this disaster, with this clear disaster on Israel's northern border, I heard that in the past few days there have actually been talks at the security cabinet, although the notion was rejected, but talks about international forces being brought to the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
Get that. It's absurd, and this is part of the policy of Omar, part of the policy of Peres, and of a lot of the Kadima and labor ministers, of the internationalization of Israel's borders. They've talked in the past about creating international zones in Jerusalem. So if what's happening in Lebanon is any measure of success or failure of the policy of international forces to protect Israel, we now see that it's not going to work and that it's going to bring confrontation that Israel really can't afford.
I'm sitting here brewing, Aaron. I'm brewing. I'm brewing.
You should.
I'm brewing. It's just heating up.
I heard these talks that it was even mentioned at the security cabinet of Ehud Olmert, the possibility of an international force in Gaza.
Wow.
With what's going on in Lebanon, with what's been going on at the Egypt-Gaza border, where international monitors allow terrorists to openly walk in and out, allow weapons to be brought in. It's just maddening at this point.
What happens if Israeli planes fly, when they fly over Lebanon? I mean, and I want to say this to the French. Israel wouldn't have to be flying over Lebanon for reconnaissance if you'd be doing your job. Just wanted to get that out. And the French take a shot at an Israeli Air Force jet. The Air Force jet returns back the favor and blows up a French installation. I mean, that what happened? I mean, that's. I mean, this whole war then broadens by thousands of miles, going from the Middle East to Europe. I mean, I can't even fathom what the repercussions would be of such a confrontation. Can you?
It would be a first-rate disaster, and it's not what would happen, it's what will happen, because I believe this absolutely will happen, if not in the near future, and it is certainly possible in the near future. If Hezbollah ever attacks Israel and the Jewish state needs to defend itself and go back into Lebanon, can you imagine having to repeat the military campaign of July and August, which was a disaster, by the way, and should never be repeated, but can you imagine Israel having to carry out a campaign with tens of thousands of international forces in the way? It will happen where there's going to be a confrontation between Israel and the French or Israel and the Germans, and just the idea of Israel at war or having to interfere militarily with a German warship is within itself. You know, the connotations to that are absurd. It will be a disaster. I think that if there's any small incident or any incident in the near future, it'll be brought immediately to the United Nations Security Council for condemnation against Israel. I don't think it would escalate further immediately. But if there is a larger confrontation where Israel needs to get at Hezbollah, that's when you're going to see Israel having to make some very dangerous moves that could spark a larger war.
Let's move south. Let's move south before I have to reach for the Prozac. Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief, WorldNetDaily.com. My guest, Sido Roth, a community of roughly 25,000 citizens living just northeast of the Gaza Strip. They are under daily barrages of rockets coming from areas that Jews once lived. Not long ago, about a year and a half ago, they're using these communities now as launching pads. You know, Aaron, you know, we sit and we talk here. Everything we described, every prophecy that we had articulated unfolds with biblical precision, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's the Negev area, Sido Roth, under fire. Folks have been killed this week. There have been some incursions by IDF forces. There's been a suicide bombing grandmother. What's this? What's going on over here?
I'll tell you, it's not prophecy. It's common sense. If you give
territory to an
enemy bent on your destruction, who outright announced beforehand that they're going to use that territory to attack you with rockets, then when indeed you give the territory away and your enemy uses it to attack you with rockets, it's not surprising. I was in Sderot a few days ago on Sunday, and the situation there is disastrous. It is an absolute emergency. A lot of the children have already been evacuated, some just for the weekend, but a lot for longer periods of time. The classrooms are unfortified. Children are afraid to go to school. Parents are afraid to send them. Shopping center is, which really normally is usually bustling with people, that's what I'm told, is absolutely deserted. And the Palestinian rocket attacks the past 5 or 6 weeks have been stepped up, and actually both Israel and the Palestinians say that the new rockets are packed with more explosives and that their firepower is now more deadly. And we've seen that. It's been an absolute miracle that after Israel withdrew from Gaza, until now there haven't been more deaths. But unfortunately, in the past few days, one woman was killed, and then a factory worker was badly injured and later died of his injuries. A bodyguard to Amir Peretz, the defense minister, had his legs sheared off. It's getting bad. And then the terrorists themselves, Hamas, has actually announced that they're compelling all Israelis to evacuate Sderot. And they're saying that after Sderot, their next goal is Ashkelon and then Ashdod, which is a port city a lot further. And this is to be taken extremely seriously. If Sderot is evacuated, if the population dwindles, then the Jewish state has no future. If the Palestinian terrorists get these Jews out of their community with the rockets, then they're going to be more emboldened. They already are emboldened to further the distance, to shoot further into more Jewish communities until those communities are evacuated, until the Jewish state is evacuated. So the prime minister, the Israeli government, needs to realize that Steve Willett is the future of Israel. If the schools aren't fortified, if the government buildings aren't fortified, then there's going to be a disaster. And even if, indeed, all the fortifications are brought in, if the government actually works the best that it can, the fact of the matter is that it's just absolutely dysfunctional to live under these situations, these circumstances, and you can't expect these sterile residents to go on forever.
You listen to Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief, WorldNetDaily.com. Aaron, can I ask you a favor? We've got to go to the news break right now and a couple of commercials. Could you hang on? I wanted to ask you about this billionaire who's trying to make a difference in Sendero, where he's come from. All right. You listen to Singer, Israel National Radio. When we come back after news break, I've got to ask the question, why is Ehud Olmert not using this as an opportunity to atone for Lebanon by just going into Gaza and wiping them out? I want to talk about this billionaire who's just shipped hundreds of children from Sendero to Eilat. You listen to Singer, Israel National Radio. Don't touch the dial.
מנגן בחצרות אלייך בא ומזמר ומנגן על מנדולינה לה Shavayam Barcelona Imereshit shamayim Ma'ala ha'olam.
Are you a Gentile interested in Torah? You're not alone. The Noahides are Gentiles that keep the seven laws of Noah. There's a thriving community of Noahides on NoahideNations.com. You can take live Torah classes, purchase books, and interact with like-minded people with articles, forums, and news that affect the Noahide community. Just go to NoahideNations.com, N-O-A-H-I-D-E Nations.com, and get connected with the children of Noah.
Hi, this is Ishai Fleischer, and I want to recommend to you Israel Rose at IsraelRose.com. It's an incredible service that I've personally used. Roses from Israel sent to anywhere in the continental U.S. Fast, not expensive, amazing quality, beautiful roses right from the land of Israel to the table of your mom, grandma, grandpa, your own Shabbos table, and it's from the land of Israel. Try it at IsraelRose.com. That's IsraelRose.com.
You have to use what God has given you so that these evil ones will be defeated and destroyed and cut out. And we don't appease them. And Israel doesn't have to be destroyed for the sake of some glorious idea that the United Nations... The hell with the United Nations! The hell with the European Union! The hell with Russia! The hell with all of them! They don't care about you! That's the bottom line. Listen to Singer, Israel National Radio.
IsraelNationalRadio.com. We're your connection to Israel.
This summer, Israel National Radio hit a record number of listeners. Our live internet stream and downloadable podcasts are reaching more people than you can imagine. Get your message across to our English-speaking worldwide audience. For advertising information, contact us at advertise@IsraelNationalRadio.com or call us toll-free from the U.S. at 1-800-270-4288. That's advertise at IsraelNationalRadio.com. Or call toll free 1-800-270-4288.
Now, the only independent news talk network in the Middle East, Israel National Radio, presents the Tovia Singer Show. Here's Tovia Singer!
All right, we are back. Singer here, Israel National Radio. Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief, WorldNetDaily.com. There's a billionaire in the land of Israel, and he just spent a lot of money taking a lot of kids from Sderot. Embattled kids obviously have to be enduring enormous psychological trauma. Bring them to Eilat for a fancy weekend. What is this guy all about? Is this just him? Is this political aspirations? Is he trying to make Perez look bad because Olmert and Perez don't like this guy?
Indeed, he's made no mistakes. When we're talking about Arkady Gaidamark, a Russian-born Israeli billionaire, he has not hidden the fact that he wants to become prime minister. He claims that if he started a party and joined the Knesset tomorrow, he'd already have, like, 20 to 25 seats. I don't know if that's accurate. For once in my life, I actually agree with Ehud Olmert and Amir Peretz on one issue, and that is that bringing these children for a weekend reprieve in a lot by this billionaire was not a good thing. If you give these children a weekend vacation, yes, it's great, but you're getting their hopes up. And when they come back, the problem is still there. When they leave their resort hotels in a lot, they're still going to be bombarded by the Qassams. But at least Gaidamark is actually doing something, unlike Peretz, unlike Ehud Olmert, who, aside from not fortifying the schools and the public buildings in Sderot, they're also not listening to the Israeli Defense Forces. The Israeli Defense Forces has, over the course of several months, petitioned the Olmert government to allow it to go into the Gaza Strip and try to stop the rockets from being fired. Until today, Olmert's only allowed surgical strikes, airstrikes against rocket facilities, artillery fire against the areas that have been used to fire the rockets, but it's not working. Even the Israeli Defense Forces, which is operating on the ground in Gaza, they're not given the go-ahead to do major ground assaults. Instead, just these surgical operations, like one in Beit Hanun about a week and a half ago, where even while the IDF was on the ground in this major city, the Palestinians managed to fire a record number of Qassams from Beit Hanun, again with the IDF on the ground, into Sderot and other Jewish communities. It's clear that the IDF has not been given the green light to do what they believe must be done. What is that? That is the reoccupation of parts of the Gaza Strip, or at a very minimum, a major operation like Defensive Shield in 2002, where you wipe out the terror infrastructure in Gaza, in northern Gaza and southern Gaza. You work to block the smuggling routes, but then when the IDF gets out, of course, the terrorists will be built back up, unless the IDF is in there full time, unless they reoccupy Gaza. Bottom line is, they're not going to be able to stop the rockets full time.
I'm returning to a question here, Aaron. Ehud Olmert is in a terrible position politically. He's got his relationship with labor is fragile. He's in an insane relationship with Lieberman. You would think that given that his approval rating is dipping below 20%, and when I say 20%, when I say with that kind of tone, I don't mean 20%, wow, so little. I can't believe there are actually 20% who support him. The one logical way that he can resurrect himself is to prove himself a warrior in Gaza, to undo the damage to some degree that he has created in Lebanon by presenting himself as someone who's a failure in the battlefield. This is Ehud Olmert's opportunity to shine. This is his opportunity to demonstrate that what happened in Lebanon is an anomaly, and he can protect the country. He can protect the citizens. Why is he reporting that he's restraining the Israeli military in Gaza? Why would he ever do that? Why not send in the whole army, go to war, and wipe out Hamas, wipe out the terrorist infrastructure, and stop the rockets?
I think there are several reasons. First, it's just not in his blood to strengthen the Israeli state. If you look at all of his moves in Lebanon, where he lost the war, petitioning to withdraw, to retreat from the West Bank, from Judea and Samaria, and give it to Hamas, retreat from Jerusalem, this is not a man who stands for strengthening the Jewish state, or maybe even understanding the idea of Jewish strength. He believes that these surgical operations are the way to go, when clearly they're not. But there's a lot more to this. A good deal of it, of course, has to do with the fact that even though everybody already knows that the policy of withdrawal is a failure, if he had to retake Gaza, then there's no more withdrawal. And even while he was in America last week, there was already talks and already leaks to the media that the policy of a unilateral withdrawal from the West Bank is still out there. Incredibly, that Omar and the Kadima Party are still looking one day to push through with this evacuation, which could never take place if Israel needed to reoccupy the Gaza Strip. Also, after Israel's major defeat in Lebanon, Omar now cannot afford another defeat like that. And the fact of the matter is that hundreds, perhaps thousands of tons of weaponry, advanced rockets, anti-tank missiles, anti-aircraft rockets have been smuggled into the Gaza Strip. Hamas now has major control of the area. They've been able to create these essentially divisions that have been training for the Israeli Defense Forces to come in. They're waiting for the IDF to strike. Any operation is going to have heavy Israeli casualties. And Omar, while he's stuck between a rock and a hard place, he can't afford not to do anything. But if he does, he knows that if he pushes through with a major operation, there are going to be major casualties. And this, within itself, can bring down the Omar government. So, for so many reasons, this coward prime minister, this prime minister who cares only about his political future, is not doing what the IDF says it's ready to do, even if it means the loss of Israeli lives.
His lesbian daughter has got to be sitting on his head and saying, "Dad, don't do it." So if he's fighting for his political life, he knows that Israelis care about the security. You know, it has to go to the point that you've made, that ultimately going into Gaza, retaking it or not, but a major operation demonstrates that the disengagement that took place more than a year ago was an absolute failure. He's unwilling to make that statement by going in. And ultimately, the Arabs are going to have to save us from ourselves. They're going to make it impossible for the IDF, for the political leadership, to restrain them. Am I reading that right?
I hope you are, but to an extent, I don't have any faith in Omar. I don't think, even if the rocket barrage continues, even if rockets are more advanced and they start they already reached Ashkelon, but they start bombarding Ashkelon and go further to Ashdod, even if they reach to Tel Aviv, I don't think Omar would allow the IDF to go back in. This is not in his strategy. It's not in his mindset. It's not part of the platform of a party that's looking to push through the expulsion of more Jews from Judea and Samaria and ultimately from Jerusalem. So I hope the Arabs save us from ourselves, but I don't think that this coward prime minister is going to call for what needs to be done in Gaza, even if attacks are stepped up, which they will be, because the Palestinians see that the rockets are working. They see what's going on in Sderot. I've talked to them. They say they're more emboldened now than ever to continue, and it's going to go on and on and on until the Israeli public realizes that Hamas is not going to fight back and that they need a new prime minister.
Ehud Olmert, I mean, there's one issue that he is he's talking about a lot, and that's Iran. He just visited the United States. He met with the President of the United States, and I'm sure most of his conversations were not about Jonathan Pollard, who just entered his 22nd year of incarceration. I'm sure it was about Iran. Are you getting any word of what happened in that conversation? Is Bush saying that we're going to do it, giving you a green light? Did you get any feedback on the conversations regarding Iran?
If you look at afterwards, at the press conference between Ulmer and Bush, it was very clear that Bush made statements that stopped way short of attacking Iran, whereas Ulmer made statements that went further. But you have to look into this and think about, well, is it really that Ulmer has been given the green light to attack Iran? And if he has, is Ulmer, the man who lost to Hezbollah in Lebanon, the man who refuses to send his troops to do what must be done in Gaza, the man who wants to give up the West Bank and Jerusalem to Hamas, is this a man who is really willing and ready to attack Iran? I don't think so. What could possibly be the other reason for these heavy Ulmer comments about attacking Iran? That is, the domestic pressure in Israel has really built up against Ulmer with regard to Iran. You have Bibi Netanyahu, who has been making these strong statements about attacking Iran, and he's the opposition. Everybody knows it. You have, even in Labor, Ephraim Sne and others calling for the attacking of Iran, or at least stopping short of calling for that. And so Ulmer is being bombarded both from the left and from the right to have some sort of strong policy with regard to Iran, and Israelis are petitioning for that policy. When they hear Bibi, when they hear Ephraim Smith, they're asking, well, what about the prime minister? So perhaps when Ulmer was in Washington, and perhaps when he was on his way back on the airplane giving these strong statements about Iran, it wasn't indeed that he's been given the green light. It wasn't indeed that he actually somehow got rid of his cowardice in attacking others. I think that it was more domestic politics, more to appease the Israelis who have been looking for Ulmer to call for something with regard to Iran. I don't think that this man is going to attack. And if he does, if Israel does attack Iran, I certainly hope that Ulmer is not prime minister at the time, because he cannot lead a military campaign.
And that I know exactly what the listeners are thinking, because they think like I do. When is Ehud Olmert going to go? What event in Israel needs to happen? Is it the budget votes that are ultimately going to bring down the government? What should we be looking for where we can have a change of leadership in the Jewish state that will lead to a change in a change of direction for the state of Israel?
It's really incredible and testament to the sanity of the Knesset and of the Israeli populace that Olmert is still in power. He should have been taken out directly for losing the war in Lebanon, directly for his mismanagement of Gaza, directly for calling for a withdrawal from the West Bank. But he's not. It seems that if he is going to be removed, it's going to be incredibly not for his failures, but by default. By default, perhaps, by the passing of the budget. We should be looking at that, and that's in December. If the 2007 state budget is not passed, then the government automatically falls. We should also be looking for what's going on internally in Labor. Amir Peretz really seems to be losing ground. Other people like Ephraim Sne, like Ehud Barak, the failed former prime minister, looking to take over. So it could be that an upheaval in Labor in the near future will cause the collapse of Ulmer. But it's just incredible that it would be by default. And I think that a lot of this has to do with the Knesset members themselves, that they're worried about their own power. When you bring down a prime minister, when you call for no confidence motions and you pass them, you not only dissolve prime minister's office, you also dissolve the Knesset, which means that the Knesset members, by bringing down Ulmer, are also calling for new elections for themselves. They're worried they might not get elected. And so you have this cycle where Ulmer is allowed to stay in, but I hope it doesn't last long, and I am looking at the next few weeks as key with what's going on in Labor and with the passing of the 2007 state budget.
Yeah, and I can see two individuals that do want to see this government go down. Avigdor Lieberman, although he has a ministerial position with Ehud Olmert, he is set if elections were held today to get numbers like 18-20, he's going to completely sweep the Russian Jewish vote. You're talking about Bibi Netanyahu seems to be in the front runner, and perhaps his approach, sort of self-peddling his way here in politics, which is not as he, that's not what comes naturally to him. It seems like his numbers are doing well. He could, has to be wanting to see another election coming soon. Obviously, National Union, right-wing governments, they want to see their numbers expand. Am I reading that right?
Indeed, and let's hope that they get their acts together. Avigdor Lieberman, though, while he does want to see Elmer brought down because he knows that he'll win more seats, at the same time, he's a political enemy of Bibi. Him and Bibi Netanyahu do not get along well. Certainly, Likud would win plenty, and Avigdor Lieberman would come in second, and that Bibi would have no choice but to form a government and put Avigdor Lieberman in a high position of power. But he wouldn't mind prolonging the Omar government for his own reasons, because he doesn't want to work with Bibi. But Bibi does have every reason to bring the government down, but he has for quite some time. So the question is when and why he's waited so long, and let's just hope that he doesn't wait any longer.
All right, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Toby Singer Show, Israel National Radio. You're listening to a special expanded interview with my guest, Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief of WorldNetDaily.com. We only have a few minutes left. This is a biblical story. The scripture describes, the book of Ezekiel and the book of Jeremiah describe that in the Messianic age, there will be an ingathering of the exiles. The people of Israel. In fact, Ezekiel 37 describes how the 10 lost tribes carried away 2,700 years ago by Assyria will be restored. Something fabulous, something marvelous is occurring. The lost tribes of Israel returning home, that's your headline. In fact, descendants of Joseph who are in India, they are coming to the land of Israel to make Aliyah. These are folks, I explain this, though. These are folks who maintained their Jewish identity for all these thousands of years and are now returning to Judaism. What's the deal there?
It's really incredible. You have this group that's been in India. They say that they were exiled about 2,700 years ago by the Assyrians. And until today, it's incredible. They've kept these customs that they couldn't explain, but they were very similar to Judaism, like Shabbos, like Bris Milah, which is not done in general in India, like kosher, like even sanctity of family, very Jewish customs, and they believe that they're descended from Joseph, from Yosef, through Menashe, and that they were been waiting since they were exiled to return. I believe that about 100 years ago, they actually tried to come to Israel on foot, or to come toward Israel on foot, but they were stopped by the Indian authorities. And then about 10 years ago, a group of about 800 B'nai Menashe were allowed to arrive here. Then the Israeli government stopped it. But then finally, this week, just the past few days, and then again today, a group of new B'nai Menashe were allowed to come because they've been officially converted by the chief rabbinate of Israel, who flew to India about a year ago to convert a group of B'nai Menashe. The rabbinate are going back to India to officially convert more. Even though they believe they're Jewish, they're going to convert more, bring more back. And so I talked with Michael Freund, who I'm sure has been on this program before. He's the head of Shalvei Israel, the group that has been largely behind the bringing back of these B'nai Menashe. And he said that it's absolutely a miracle of biblical significance. And I'll tell you, when they get here, they're not living in luxury condos in Tel Aviv. They are moving to the heartland of Israel. They're moving to Hebron. I actually visited some of them in Gush Katif. They were expelled. Yeah. Those who were expelled are now living amongst the other expellees in the Negev. They join the Israeli army. They're incredibly patriotic, Zionistic, and Israel should be lucky to get a group like this coming here.
Could you imagine traveling from North India, waiting thousands of years to come to the land of Israel? They arrive at the land of Israel, move into a place, they move into Gush Katif, they move to Gaza, only to be expelled. And I'm laughing because I have no way of processing that. And I've met some of these people. They are, as you said, wonderful, very soft, very gentle people with deep love for the land of Israel. And I think this goes to the point that you'd made earlier. The reason I'm wondering why the Israeli government is hesitant, and I'll just use that word, the Israeli government is cautious about bringing these B'nai Menashe, these Jews from North India to the land of Israel, is because they have a tendency not to move to Tel Aviv. They have a tendency to move to Hebron, to Shiloh, to Eilat, and at one time Gush Katif. That means that these thousands of Indian Jews who have been lost, been disconnected from the Jewish people for so long, they're filling the ranks of Judea and Samaria. Do you think that might have a reason why the government is not that excited about bringing them in?
I think that's the underlying absolute reason. And even further, it's that these Indian Jews espouse all of the ideology of religious Zionism, of religion, and you have these people in the government who are literally, and this is the baseline, the bottom line of every story here in Israel, this war, religious versus secular, the government targeting the religious communities of Gush Katif, targeting the religious communities of Judea and Samaria. They don't want to bring more religious people here who would enhance the religious ideology, but certainly it's the fact that they're moving to Judea and Samaria that furthers it for them, and that's why they've been placing every obstacle in the way of Michael Freund and others who have been bringing these people here at great expense, but doing an excellent job.
Yeah. We have exactly 60 seconds left. The Democrats swept both houses. There are some Republicans like Chafee who are gone, good riddance, and there are some folks who have come in who are friends of Israel overall. I know the terrorists are happy. This I know. they are delighted. But is there something, I mean, Charles Rangel, something we need to watch out for? Overall, is this good news or bad news for Israel?
It's disastrous news for Israel. Not specific politicians, but overall, this new policy of withdrawal from Iraq is going to be a disaster for Israel. And the policy by James Baker and others of centralizing the Middle East conflict back to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, back to negotiations, is going to be a tragedy for Israel. The Democrats don't believe they're anti-Israel. They believe they're doing what Israel wants them to do. But withdrawal from Iraq and their overall arching policy for the Middle East is not good for Israel.
Aaron Klein, Jerusalem Bureau Chief, WorldNetDaily.com. Thank you for joining us here on Israel National Radio.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.